How convicted are we all of the truth? How convinced are we that what the Church of God is teaching is correct? Do we believe what we believe only because the Church teaches it? Unfortunately, this would be a big mistake. Unless you are convinced yourself, and we heard in the sermonette today about personal conviction. Unless you are convinced yourself and have proven to yourself, based on the Bible, that what you believe is true, I guarantee that the time will come where your faith, quote-unquote, is going to be severely tested. There was a time when many, many people believed the same thing in the church. And then there came a time when Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong died and a new leadership took over, and when they began to systematically change one teaching after the other, that many, and I mean many, followed those new teachings. And I have wondered many times, why was this possible? How was it possible? How could it happen? Well, I believe part of the reason is that these people had never, ever convinced themselves that what they believed was the truth. And when, quote-unquote, alternatives were presented, they followed the pattern they had followed all along just to accept what the church taught, never making a personal, individual conviction out of it. And so that's why we have today, in what was the Worldwide Church of God, of course the name was changed recently, we have now people who keep Christmas. We have people who keep Easter. I don't know how many keep Halloween. We have people who keep Sunday. We have people who have totally rejected the Sabbath, totally rejected the holy days. I mean, you just name it. People who now believe that you have an immortal soul which goes to heaven or which goes to hell when you die. There's virtually no doctrine left which the former Worldwide Church of God hasn't changed. Today I'd like to talk about another important doctrine, and I mean doctrine. And this doctrine has to do with the revivals of the Roman Empire. I dare to say that unless you totally understand what the Bible teaches in this regard, and what the Church has been teaching for almost a century now, Mr. Armstrong has been teaching that in 1940, 1950, prior even to that. But unless you have understood why the Church has been teaching what the Church is teaching, you will probably be one of those candidates of Satan and his ministers who come in and present alternatives so that you can be tossed to and fro with every wind of doctrine. And I have already been hearing a lot of speculations about alternatives. Speculations to the effect that if you look at Revelation chapter 17, which talks about a woman sitting on a beast, and most of you, I know, understand what the Church is teaching in this regard. But I have heard ideas now that this means the United States of America is directing and guiding Europe. I have heard ideas that this has nothing to do with the Catholic Church, this has nothing to do with the European Empire, the ancient Roman Empire being revived. I've heard all kinds of ideas. If you read commentaries on Revelation 17, let's say, or on the book of Daniel, or on Revelation 13, you will find that most do not at all accept or even consider the concept that the Roman Empire is being described here, which is being revived in history, totally ignoring, totally rejecting the historical record. And they basically tell you either it's talking about 10 kings living at the same time, and mostly they don't even talk about in prophetic terms. They say it's talking about the time of John, and John wrote. This talks about the ancient Roman rulers. And John just wrote that to encourage the people. In other words, he made up this kind of fanciful story to just encourage the people so that they have something to look forward to. Of course, rejecting the Bible throughout their explanations. Because everything which is written in the book of Revelation ultimately culminates in the return of Jesus Christ. And unless we understand that the church is teaching what it is teaching based on history, you will not understand in what times we are living. And that's why I said it's a doctrine. It is a very important doctrine. Without it, without this important key, you will not understand what the circumstances of today are. Now, I know some are bored by that. Some don't like history. They never really liked history. They wonder, why is it so important that we actually go into that? Well, let me tell you this. If God went through all the trouble, as he did, to give powerful visions to Daniel about peculiar-looking beasts and the statue Nebuchadnezzar saw in a dream, and then he goes through all the trouble and gives John all these visions in the book of Revelation about these beasts, culminating in the return of Christ, I believe he wants you and me to understand what he is telling us. He wants you and me to understand what it means to watch world events and to pray and to understand the signs of the time. So this cannot be, must not be a boring issue for you. It must be an absolutely exciting one, because then and only then can you understand what is happening today and why in Europe, in America, in the Middle East, in other parts of the world. So what I like to begin to do today is to go through the historical records. I will try to stay away from any articles, any books which have been written, which try to look into the Bible and then start to write about history, putting it under biblical terms. The reason I don't want to do that is because many times the allegation can be made, oh, well, you're just putting it together in such a way so that it fits. Mr. Armstrong many years wrote a booklet on the Middle Eastern prophecy. And when he went through the book of Daniel chapter 11, he looked through historical records and just showed from history what happened. And then, after he established that, he could show how all of that was prophesied in Daniel 11. So let's do the same thing today. Let's talk about the revivals of the Roman Empire from strictly a historical standpoint. Now, we have written a booklet, Europe in Prophecy, The Unfolding of End Time Events, and you have all read that, I know. You've read it many, many times. You're all very much familiar with virtually every word which is in it. I'm speaking a little bit facetiously. But in the middle of that booklet, there's a chart. And this chart talks about Daniel's and John's visions of Gentile rulership. And this chart gives you all kinds of biblical scriptures, insofar as what the dream in Daniel 2 had to do with the return of Jesus Christ. See, Nebuchadnezzar had that dream, and he saw that statute. Now, the interesting thing is, if you look at all these different scriptures, which I will not do today, also scriptures in the book of Revelation, you will find that it was prophesied to Daniel. In fact, it was a dream given to Nebuchadnezzar, but then Daniel was allowed to interpret it, understand what it meant, that there would only be four empires on this earth until the return of Jesus Christ. Only four. The first one was the Babylonian. The second one was the Medo-Persian. The third one was the Greco-Macedonian. And the fourth one was the Roman Empire. And then Jesus Christ would return. Now, we all know that the Roman Empire fell. But the point is, in other scriptures in the book of Daniel and in the book of Revelation, it's pointed out that the Roman Empire would be revived 10 times. That ancient Roman Empire would be revived 10 times, signified by 10 horns, which that particular beast had in Revelation 13, also in Daniel. It's still the Roman Empire. It's still that empire which would exist until Christ returns, but it would revive 10 times. 9 of those revivals have occurred historically. The 10th revival we are seeing unfolding in front of our very eyes in Europe right now. Unless you understand that those 9 revivals have already occurred, you do not know, you cannot know, that we are now watching the 10th revival. And the Bible says that 10th revival is going to be a very short one. When it happens, it will only last for a very short time. So as we see the European Union coming together, and as we heard in the announcements, ultimately 10 nations or groups of nations will come out of this, and then they in turn will give their authority and their power to a charismatic leader, a political, military, economic leader. And when that happens, he will only rule for a short time. Unless you understand all of that, you're not going to be able to see that this is happening in front of our very eyes. You see, if you miss one of those resurrections, those revivals, you may be off. You may think, well, we haven't really seen the nine yet. Maybe you've only seen seven or six or five or whatever. So you still have a long time to go. How do you know that nine of those 10 revivals have already taken place? Now, in our booklet, we have on the right side a list where we say interpretation and historical fulfillment. We have a list of those 10 revivals. 9 which have already occurred, 1 which is occurring right now in front of us. But again, how do you know that that is true? How do you know that we, that Mr. Armstrong, whoever, didn't just come up with that in order to make it all fit? So today, I want to begin reading to you from historical books about those revivals. Now again, I didn't go to the internet or to bookstores to just desperately look for something I could possibly find which make it all fit. I just grabbed some history books. And you can do the same thing. And I went to the internet, but I didn't go to religious sites. I went to historical sites. And I went through my books I have at home talking about history. And showing from these books, which I will now read excerpts to today, to you, showing very clearly why we are saying what we are saying. Trying to put some more pieces into the puzzle. You see, we all should understand the trunk of the tree. The trunk of the tree being there have been 9 revivals. But let's talk a little bit about the branches. Let's talk a little bit about the leaves. Let's put some more points into this picture so we understand and can be convinced personally that what we are saying is true. We all know the Roman Empire fell. But the Bible says in Revelation 13, we read that last time, that the deadly wound would be healed. We also read in the book of Daniel. Now, we didn't necessarily mention that last time. I'd like to just quote a little bit from our booklet on European prophecy, what we say about a prophecy in Daniel chapter 7, because in Daniel chapter 7, there is talk about a little horn. A beast is introduced there with 10 horns. And we point out that these are the 10 revivals, but then there is a little horn mentioned. And in Daniel chapter 7 and verse 8, let me just quote it to you, Daniel says, "I was considering the 10 horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom 3 of the first horns were plucked out by the roots." So this scripture tells us that there would be 3 horns, 3 empires, as we will see, 3 revivals of the Roman Empire, which would then be plucked out through the influence of this little horn. The little horn is also described as one which is going to begin to change times and seasons. The times which God has declared holy, the seasons which define what days to keep. And we already heard last time that, for instance, in Europe, the calendar was changed. And that Sunday is no longer listed as the first day of the week over there in those calendars. It's now listed as the last day of the week, Sabbath. And so this little horn, which is really none other than the Roman Catholic Church, has in fact changed the Sabbath to Sunday. It has in fact changed the annual holy days of God to holidays which are being kept today in Orthodox Christianity, which are pagan in origin, which have nothing to do with true Christianity. Now let's see what happened, though, historically. In our list, we have pointed out that the first revival of that Roman Empire, when it fell, was done under King Gaiseric of the Vandals. Now I have a little bit of a problem sometimes with pronunciation, because When I was in school, we gave German terms to these words, and they are quite different from the American way of explaining them. I'm not going to make any judgment as to what pronunciation is correct, but I will sometimes refer to perhaps the German way or the Latin way so that we all are on the same wavelengths. So we are saying here, and we have been saying this as long as I can remember, that the first revival of the fallen Roman Empire occurred under Gaiseric, sometimes referred to as Genseric, of the Vandals. Now, what do we know about this Gaiseric, this Genseric? What do we know about the Vandals? Let me just read to you from the Wikipedia. The Wikipedia says, Genseric, also spelled as Gaiseric, was king of the Vandals and was one of the key players in the troubles of the Western Roman Empire in the 5th century. And let me just interrupt here. What we are talking about, what the Bible is talking about, is the revivals of what we call the Western Roman Empire, surrounding the city of Rome. It's not concerned about what is referred to in history, the Eastern Roman Empire, Constantinople, Byzantine, as it is sometimes called, or was called. Today is Istanbul. It's not concerned about that. It's only concerned about that insofar as the quote-unquote Eastern Roman Empire had some relationship with the Western Roman Empire. I say this on purpose because sometimes I've heard the idea that somehow the Eastern Roman Empire will also be revived. There's nothing in the Bible talking about that at all. You see, Istanbul has been under Turkish rule for many, many years. It's still under Turkish rule today. There is no indication that Turkey even will join the EU. I personally don't believe they will. So, what the Bible is talking about is the resurrection, the revival of the Western Roman Empire, not the Eastern. Okay, going back now to this Gaiseric, he gave troubles, it says, to the Western Roman Empire. It goes on to say in this article that in 439, the Romans were caught unaware, and this Gaiseric captured a large part of the Western Roman navy docked in the port of, I pronounce it, Carthago. I look at the internet and they say you can pronounce it Car-Thai. I don't know how in the world they come to that pronunciation. You spell it C-A-R-T-H-A-G-E. The Latin Greek pronunciation would be Carthago, but that is a famous city. That's where the Romans were defeated. It goes on to say, interestingly enough, the Catholic bishop of the city was exiled to Naples, since Gaiseric demanded that all his close advisors follow the Arian form of Christianity. You see, he was the first of those three barbaric tribes, barbaric in quotes, who belonged to the Arian faith. He was not a Roman Catholic. He didn't believe in what the Roman Catholic Church taught. He believed in Arianism. Now, Arianism was a teaching which had some right and some wrong teachings. They believed, for instance, that God was not a Trinity. They were correct there. But they also did not believe that Christ was divine, so they were wrong there. But anyhow, he belonged to a faith different from the Catholic Church, and so there were conflicts. It goes on to say that the Gaiseric gave freedom of religion to the Catholics while insisting that the regime's elite follow Arianism. The common folk had low taxes under his reign, as most of the tax pressure was on the rich Roman families and the Catholic clergy. Didn't make him very popular amongst the Catholic clergy. The kingdom of the Vandals now threatened the empire for mastery of the Western Mediterranean Sea. Carthago, however you want to pronounce it, became the new Vandal capital and an enemy of Rome for the first time since the Punic Wars. We read more about this first barbarian, as they call him, Gaiseric. It goes on to say that in 455, Gaiseric and his men landed on Italian soil and marched on Rome, where Pope Leo I implored him not to destroy the ancient city or murder its inhabitants. Gaiseric agreed, and the gates of Rome were thrown open to him and his men. Although history remembers the Vandal sack of Rome as extremely brutal, making the word vandalism a term for any wantonly destructive acts. In actuality, the Vandals did not wreak great destruction in the city. They did, however, take gold, silver, and many other things of value. Many important people were taken hostage for even more riches. And also his son, married the daughter of the last Roman emperor, Valentinian III, when he was killed. He destroyed Rome. That's what the historians tell us is actually the time when they say that Rome fell. But the key to remember is he stayed and became the first ruler after he had kind of sacked it. He stayed there, reviving Rome until he died. Let me also say this. Many people, because they are confused about the wording, think that the Vandals, for instance, that Gaiseric, for instance, was a German. That isn't necessarily the case. You see, many times you read in books about the Germans, but they mean what you would say in Germany, the Germanen, or the Germanic tribes. The Germanic tribes were not necessarily German at all. You see, the Germanic tribes consisted of tribes like people coming from Denmark, from Sweden, from Norway, even from Britain. They would also include the Germans. They would also include the Goths or the Franks. The problem is that, let's go back to the house of Israel and the house of Judah. You had the 12 sons of Israel, and first they were all together, but later, under King Solomon's son, the two empires broke apart, and you had then the house of Israel, consisting of pretty much 10 tribes, and the house of Judah. Now, today, you would look at the house of Judah and say, well, these are the Jews, and that's pretty much accurate. In other words, today you have the state of Israel, consisting of the Jews and certain ones from Benjamin and certain ones from Levi. Pretty much the house of Judah. The house of Israel, however, became known as the lost 10 tribes. After their captivity by the Assyrians, they took them eastward, and then later they would march back and move back westward. And so today, of course, we understand that many of those descendants of the lost 10 tribes are to be found in Great Britain, the United States of America, Canada, Australia, insofar as the English-speaking nations are concerned, the descendants of Joseph. But then you also had other Israel tribes, Israeli tribes, so to speak. They were not Jewish, never were. And so there is speculation, and there is evidence to the effect that, for instance, the Vandals and also the other two barbarian tribes we're going to talk about in a moment were actually descendants of the ancient house of Israel. I'm just saying that in passing, because people get confused when they read about the Germanic tribes thinking they had to be Germans. That's not true at all. See, you would never make that mistake in the German language or in the French language. You make the mistake in the English language only because they use the word Germany for the Germans, and then you have the word for the Germanic tribes, and it sounds pretty similar. In Germany, you have a totally different word for Germany, that's Deutschland. And then when you come to the Germanic tribes, you call them German, totally different words. No confusion possible. The confusion is possible, and it's made quite a bit in historical records here in the United States and in England because they don't understand the distinction. All right. So we have been reading about the first revival of the Roman Empire under the Vandals, who became then the second revival. Now, in our chart, if you remember, we talked about the second revival happened under King Odoacer of the Heruli, or Heruli, however you want to pronounce it, H-E-R-U-L-I. Now, what do we learn about this Odoacer, and how did this come about? And does history back up what we are saying? I'm quoting from the Columbia Encyclopedia, saying about Odoacer, he and his troops were mercenaries in the service of Rome, but in 476 the Heruli revolted and proclaimed Odoacer their king. Odoacer defeated the Roman general Orestes, took Ravenna, the West Roman capital, and deposed Romulus Augustulus, last Roman emperor of the West, until, notice this, the coronation in 800 of Charlemagne. It goes on to say that Zeno, now this was an emperor who lived in the eastern part of the Roman Empire, what you would call today Constantinople or Istanbul. Zeno sent Theodoric the Great, the king of the Ostrogoths, into Italy to expel Odoacer. So now we have already the second and the third mentions. Several times defeated, Odoacer consented to a treaty by which he was to share his authority with Theodoric. Invited to a banquet by Theodoric, Odoacer and his son and chief officers were treacherously assassinated. Thus, Theodoric made himself master of Italy. So you have first the Vandals. You have secondly now, as we have just found out, the Heruli Odoacer. And now comes the third guy. The third guy, Theodoric. Theodoric was an Ostrogoth. Not necessarily a German. Could have been, though. You don't know for sure. But there is indication that these were actually members of the ancient house of Israel, coming from countries like Denmark, Sweden, Norway, and even Scotland and Ireland. Now, what about this emperor Zeno? He was the one who ruled in Constantinople. It says here in the Great Encyclopedia of Biography, the emperor Zeno convinced Theodoric that the western part of the empire offered richer plunder than the east, and he commissioned Theodoric, to go to Italy and to punish the barbarian general Odoacer, who had in 476 dismissed Zeno's co-emperor and assumed his rule. Theodoric's mission was to defeat Odoacer and pacify Italy. But what about now this Theodoric? What do we know about him? It says, Theodoric and the Ostrogoths were Arians, their heretical version of Christianity being particularly repellent to Orthodox Romans. And then we find that Arianism later began to increasingly alienate the Romans. And this Theodoric persecuted Pope John I in 526 and later demanded that all churches be turned over to Arians. You see, these three barbarian tribes were Arians. And Daniel tells us that this little horn would see to it that they would be plucked out. Those first three revivals of the Roman Empire would be plucked out and be replaced by something. As we will see, they would be replaced by the Roman Catholic faith. And that is why the concept, some say, that when the woman riding the beast in Revelation 17 refers to somehow America riding Europe, is not only blatantly nonsense, for the simple reason that that has never happened in the history of the revivals of the Roman Empire. When has the United States of America ever directed Charlemagne, let's say, as we will see in a moment, that didn't even exist? It is also blatantly nonsense because it is a Catholic Church, as we will see now, which, beginning with the Fourth Revival, has had a relationship. Not necessarily always control, but relationship with the emperors. Because the next one who is coming on the scene is Justinian the First. Justinian the First, and we say in our handout, in our chart, that he brought about the imperial restoration of the two parts of the empire. Now let's talk a little bit about this Justinian, because he has great consequence and relevance for us today, as you will see in a moment. Let me read from the Wikipedia again about Justinian the First. It says here, commonly known as Justinian the Great. He was the Roman Byzantine, or Byzantine, in Latin it's Byzantium, another name for Constantinople. So he was this Roman Byzantine emperor from 527 to 565. During his reign, Justinian sought to revive the empire's greatness and we conquer the lost western half of the classical Roman Empire. This ambition was expressed in the partial recovery of the territories of the Western Roman Empire, including the city of Rome itself. Notice this. Justinian is considered a saint amongst Eastern Orthodox Christians, and he is also commemorated by some Lutheran churches. This article goes on to say and explain how Justinian and his army defeated the Ostrogoths. They did so decisively, it says, at the Battle of Brista Gallorum and later at Mons Lactarius. So they wiped them out. It goes on to say, at the very beginning of his reign, he deemed it proper to promulgate by law the Church's belief in the Trinity and the Incarnation, and to threaten all heretics, including all those who believed in Arianism, with the appropriate penalties. Justinian protected the purity of the Church by suppressing heretics. He neglected no opportunity for securing the rights of the Church and clergy. The recognition of the Roman See as the highest ecclesiastical authority remains the cornerstone of his Western policy. He was the one who was instrumental for establishing the Roman See. It goes on to say, Justinian's religious policy reflected the imperial conviction that the unity of the empire unconditionally presupposed unity of faith, and it appeared to him obvious that this faith could be only the Orthodox faith. He established all kinds of laws, the Codex Justinianus, the Code of Justinian. It says the Codex contained two statutes which decreed the total destruction of paganism, but paganism was defined as everything but Orthodox Christianity. Even in private life, these provisions were zealously enforced. The Jews, too, had to suffer, for not only did the authorities restrict their civil rights and threaten their religious privileges, but the emperor interfered in the internal affairs of the synagogue. But not only did the Jews have to suffer. In our booklet on European prophecy, I want to read to you from page 18 what else happened during Justinian's rule. We are quoting here Will Durant in his book, The Age of Faith, Volume 4, of his renowned works, The Story of Civilization, saying about the Code of Justinian, quote, "This code, like the Theodosian, enacted Orthodox Christianity into law. It began by declaring for the Trinity. It acknowledged the ecclesiastical leadership of the Roman Church." We know this, but now, "and ordered all Christian groups to submit to her authority. Relapsed heretics were to be put to death, and other dissenters were to suffer confiscation of their goods, and were declared incompetent to buy or sell, to inherit or bequeath. They were excluded from public office, forbidden to meet, and disqualified from suing Orthodox Christians for debt." And, you guessed it, Sabbath keeping was no longer allowed. So, this is this saint, Justinian, who brought about the rule of Rome, the fourth resurrection of the Roman Empire. Now we come to the fifth one. The first one happened under Charlemagne, Charles the Great, Karl der Große, as he is called in Germany. Again, I have several books I'd like to read to you from, just to give you an idea what the historians say about Charlemagne, to see that we are absolutely correct to refer to him as a revival of the ancient Roman Empire. In fact, the most important revival, if you please, when it comes to history and to his legacy. Here's a book with the title, The Living World of History. And the book has this to say about Charlemagne, starting with his grandfather, Charles Martel. It says, Charles Martel made 732 a memorable year in European annals. The Moslems, who were then masters of Spain, surged into France with a great host. But Charles smashed their armies and destroyed their hopes of further conquests in the decisive battle of Poitiers. Charles' son, Pepin the Short, as I was called, presented the papacy with certain districts in central Italy which he had captured from the barbarous Lombards. Thus the Pope, besides being the spiritual head of Western Christendom, became a territorial prince as ruler of the papal states. Then it goes on to say, from this vigorous ancestor sprang the most illustrious hero of the Dark Ages. Interestingly enough, this book is written and was published in Great Britain. But you see how much of an admiration they had and have for Charles the Great, because that's the one we're talking about, Charles the Great or Charlemagne. He reigned over the reunited kingdom from 771 to 814, and he made to his aim to bring all the German peoples, better Germanic peoples, into one great Christian empire. For this lofty ambition, he was well fitted by nature. He was bold and statesmanlike, tireless and swift, genial and hearty. His commanding figure, they say it was about 2 meters high, whatever that is in feet, I don't know, but tall. His commanding figure and keen blue eyes, his lively spirit and simple tastes made him the idol of his warriors. He became a figure of legend, the hero of incredible adventures. His sword never rusted. He extinguished the Lombard kingdom, drove the Muslims from the buffer province he created south of the Pyrenees, hounded the pagan Saxons till he had subdued them and forced them to accept Christianity. He completed the work of bringing Germany under Frankish rule and advanced his power deep into Central Europe. But the peak of his glory was scaled in Rome. The Roman emperor in Constantinople, East Rome, who reigned over the East and nominally over the West, had been dethroned. In 800, the Pope crowned Charlemagne emperor in his place. It showed how ineradicably the Roman imperial tradition had survived the centuries of barbarian conquest in the West. It goes on to say, Charlemagne stands out as a monumental figure with a sword in one hand, a torch in the other. Before his coming, Western Europe was engulfed in anarchy and ignorance. The royal Christian warrior brought a semblance of order out of chaos, giving a measure of reality to his vision of a Christian state in which all the diverse peoples of the West should be knit together after the civilized Roman pattern. He is clearly looked upon in historical records, and you can look at many, many of them, as the founder of the quote-unquote Holy Roman Empire. Holy, because now there was a connection between the state and the Roman Church. Here's an article from a book I have at home entitled Kingdoms of Europe. And this says about Charlemagne, in the old Roman times, the Roman people had always elected the emperor. They now elected him. On Christmas Day of the year 800, as Karl the Frank, Charles the Great, knelt down before the altar of St. Peter's, the Pope placed a crown on his head, and the Roman people cried out, to Carolus Augustus, crowned by God, the great and peaceful emperor of the Romans, life and victory. So the empire of the West, which had died away for a time, or emerged in the empire of the East at Constantinople, was brought to life again in the person of Charlemagne. They're not writing this from a biblical standpoint. They couldn't care less about the Bible. But you see, it clearly proves that Charlemagne revived the ancient Roman Empire. It goes on to say, Aachen was the capital of this empire. There Charlemagne had built a great cathedral and a palace for himself. His chosen Christian name of David fitted him well, for he was a great benefactor of the church. He gathered together the bishops several times during his reign to consult on the church's good and defense. And now listen to these statements. Charlemagne succeeded through relentless military and missionary campaigns in bringing the areas of present day Germany, France, Switzerland, Austria, Northern Italy, and the Low Countries within a precariously unified administration. His coronation as emperor by Pope Leo III in Rome on Christmas Day, AD 800, marks the emergence of a successor in Western and Central Europe to the defunct Western Roman Empire, which could protect the papacy and assume equality with the Byzantine successor of the empire in the East. And on it goes. He is clearly referred to as the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. It says here on another page of the same book, he was crowned emperor in 800 by Leo III. He is considered by many scholars as the father of the Holy Roman Empire. I also found an interesting article in a German magazine. It's called PM History. And again, this is a total non-religious magazine. But they pointed something out which I felt was rather interesting, because it shows that Napoleon and also the Emperor Wilhelm in Germany had great admiration for Charlemagne. Both wished that they could be successors of Charlemagne. But also in the year of 1000, King Otto III went to the cathedral in Aachen, which, you know, Charlemagne had built and where his corpse was placed, and he opened that section where he had been buried, and the legend has it that he was found there not being decayed. Now, whether that legend is true or not, I don't know, but that's something which you can find in all these books. After Charlemagne died, his empire disintegrated until the next leader popped up. And now, a chart, we refer to him as Otto the Great, but how can we say that? How can we say that Otto the Great was the next revival of the ancient Roman Empire? Now, the book I quoted from earlier, The Living World of History, has an article on Otto the Great, entitled Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. And it goes on to say, in 936 came Otto the First, who launched Germany on a new and adventurous course. Otto had made himself the most powerful monarch in Europe. The ideal of the old Roman Empire as a civilized community embracing all Christendom under the enlightened rule of Pope and Emperor still lingered on. And then in 962, the Pope crowned him Emperor. Thus began the so-called Holy Roman Empire, technically of the German nation. Because, see, the Holy Roman Empire had already begun under Charlemagne. Now it became the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation under Otto the Great, which would actually last until 1806, when the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation was dissolved. It's important we don't get confused about this, because some have written me and said, oh, this is all wrong, because the Holy Roman Empire existed until 1806. So you're teaching that Napoleon, as we will see, maybe not today, maybe next time, resurrected it, can't be true. Well, what they don't understand is the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation lasted to 1806. But it was already kind of disintegrating long before that. Napoleon resurrected it later, but it was then the Roman Empire, or Holy Roman Empire, but no longer of the German nation. But we come to that when we reach Napoleon. First, let's go back to Otto the Great. It says here in an article by the Kingdom of Europe, or the Kingdoms of Europe, the formal revival of the Holy Roman Empire dates from 962, when Otto the First, Otto the Great, received the title Imperator et Augustus in Rome. So again, this is an historical book. Has nothing to do, doesn't want to say anything about the Bible. It confirms that Otto the Great again revived the ancient Roman Empire. In a German book I found, in a German article, another legend is mentioned. In fact, this is a book, Die Entstehung Europas, meaning the beginnings of Europe. And in this article, it points out that Otto carried the Holy Lance when he went to war. And this goes back to the idea that this was this lance or this spear which the Roman soldier took and which he then thrust into Christ on the cross. And so this holy lance, according to legend, makes you unconquerable and you cannot be injured and you will always win in battle. Now, that kind of piqued my interest, and so I went on the internet to research a little bit about that. Well, what is that all about? I heard about it vaguely, but I didn't know too much about it. And so I went to the Wikipedia, and first I found this article on Otto the Great. Let me just read a few excerpts from that. It says very clearly, Otto the First is considered the first holy Roman emperor from the Kingdom of Germany. Though Charlemagne of the Carolingian dynasty was the first to receive papal coronation as emperor of the Romans. So in other words, we have Charles the Great. He started the Holy Roman Empire. Now you have Otto the Great starting the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation. Notice this now, important. Charles the Fifth was the last Holy Roman Emperor to be crowned by the Pope. The last Holy Roman Emperor of the German nation, that is. Charles the Fifth we'll talk about later, because that's probably the figure which is less known by people in the church. Who was that guy? Why do we fear that Charles the Fifth was instrumental to bring up another revival? There's a lot to be said about him, but we can't confuse him with other Charles the Fifth, because there were several. We are talking about Charles the Fifth of Habsburg. But we come to him later. Let's go back to this article about Otto. The standard designation of the Holy Roman Emperor was Augustus Emperor of the Romans. When Charlemagne was crowned in 800, his was styled as Most Serene Augustus, crowned by God, great and pacific emperor, governing the Roman Empire, thus constituting the elements of holy and Roman in the imperial title. The word Roman was a reflection of the transfer of rule principle that regarded the Germanic Holy Roman Emperors as the inheritors of the title of emperor of the Western Roman Empire. So now the transfer took place to the Germans under Otto the Great and his successors. After Charlemagne was crowned Roman Emperor by the Pope, his successors maintained the title until the death of Berengar I of Italy in 924. No Pope appointed an emperor again until Otto the Great. Now notice this. The Pope appointed Charlemagne. The next one who was appointed as emperor was Otto the Great. Otto is considered the first holy Roman emperor, I'm adding, of the German nation. Under Otto and his successors, much of the former Carolingian kingdom, kingdom by Charlemagne, of eastern Francia became the Holy Roman Empire. And so Otto now had this holy lance. Now what's about that? It says the Holy Roman Emperors had a lance of their own, attested from the time of Otto the First. It's part of a collection, and all of them are called the Imperial Regalia, or in German, the Reichskleinodien. These Imperial Regalia consisted and consist of the Imperial Crown, the Holy Lance, and the Imperial Sword. It says here that the Roman Empire, the Holy Roman Empire, was disbanded in 1806. We talk about the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation. Was disbanded in 1806, and these Reichskleinodien, or these Imperial Regalia, remained in the keeping of the Habsburgs. During the Anschluss, that is when Hitler marched into Austria, during the Anschluss, when Austria was annexed to Germany, the Reichskleinodien, or Imperial Regalia, were returned to Nuremberg, afterwards hidden. They were found by invading U.S. troops and returned to Austria by American General George S. Patton after World War II, which could really turn out to be a big mistake. Because it goes on to say, today they are kept in the Schatzkammer, or treasury, in the Hofburg Palace in Vienna, Austria. And then it talks about the imperial crown. It says, along with the imperial cross, the imperial sword, the holy lance, the imperial crown was the most important part of the imperial regalia, Currently, the crown and the rest of the imperial regalia, including the Holy Lands, are exhibited at the Hofburg in Vienna, officially, notice, until there is again a Holy Roman Emperor of the German nation. They still expect one to arise. It says the imperial crown of the Holy Roman Empire was recently selected as the main motif for a high-value commemorative coin. The 100 euro imperial crown of the Holy Roman Empire commemorative coin, minted in 2008. The obverse shows the imperial crown of the Holy Roman Empire. The reverse shows the Emperor Otto the Great with old St. Peter's Basilica in Rome in the background, where his coronation took place. And I have a copy of this coin, which was made in 2008, showing the imperial crown. So, this a little bit as an aside, but showing you that these ideas are still very much alive today. The idea of the Holy Lands, the idea of the Holy Crown, the idea that another Holy Roman Emperor of the German nation will arise. In fact, I've heard stories, I wasn't able to clearly verify them, that Hitler was very much interested in getting that Holy Lands. Whether he believed in it superstitiously or not, I don't know. But anyway, this was Otto the Great. Now let's talk about the next resurrection. The one, as I said, who is probably not that much known amongst even people in the church. Charles the Fifth. Why do we say, and I've heard those questions, why do we say that Charles the Fifth of Habsburg is the seventh resurrection? Why not some of the other famous leaders in the Middle Ages? What's so important about Charles V? Now, we have already seen. Charles V was another one who was crowned by the Pope, in fact, the last one, until Napoleon came along. And even Napoleon was crowned in a slightly different way, as we know. Probably don't know, but we'll talk about it. What about Charles V? Who was he? Why is that so important we understand? Because, again, this too has a lot of relevance for us today. In this book, The Living World of History, we read, Charles V was crowned in 1520. He dominated Europe. He was from the tribe, the family of Habsburg. It says, the Habsburg Charles V was born with not one, but half a dozen silver spoons in his mouth. The world-ranging dominions to which he succeeded had been accumulated less by the clash of swords than by the pealing of wedding bells. He says his grandfather, the Emperor Maximilian, had gained the Netherlands by marrying Mary of Burgundy. His father, Philip the Handsome, had espoused Joanna, not our Joanna over here, but a Joanna, daughter of Ferdinand of Aragon and Isabella of Castile, and as such, you know, the one who would inherit Spain, the Kingdom of Naples, embracing southern Italy, and Sicily, and the growing Spanish dominions in the recently discovered New World. And the Habsburg family's inheritance already included Austria and other districts, as well as the imperial crown of Germany. Such was the colossal empire that Charles possessed when, at the age of 20, he became and was crowned Holy Roman Emperor in 1520. 20 years old, he became the Holy Roman Emperor. It's interesting that Daniel says, even when it comes to the last revival, those 10 nations or groups of nations, they will not really be strongly holding together, but they will mingle because through marriages. And that's something which has happened throughout the history of Europe, and here in the case of the Habsburgs, that is exactly what happened already then. It goes on to say, in politics, a great drama was played out with all Europe at the stage, and Charles V, Francis I of France, and Henry VIII of England as its leading characters. The main contest between Charles and Francis was waged in Italy. Francis, by a brilliant feat of arms in 1515, has taken Milan, to which he claimed hereditary rights. But Charles, too, claimed the prize as part of his Spanish inheritance, and in the Battle of Pavia in 1525, his Spanish generals retook it together with Francis himself for good measure. 2 years later, when the Pope was intriguing against Charles, that would have been in 1527, he his troops sacked Rome and imprisoned the Pope. Eventually, France gave in and Milan fell under the power of the Empire. And then there's more to be said about Charles V, but I was reading this particular portion to also clear up a misunderstanding. Many times people feel that when it talks in the book of Revelation that the woman is riding the beast or the woman is sitting on the beast, that it is the woman, the Roman Catholic Church, which is directing the affairs of the beast. The woman is in charge, and the beast is just following the lead of the woman. You know, like James is talking about, that when you are riding a horse, you are in charge of that horse. That is not what is meant in the book of Revelation, chapter 17, and that is not what happened in history. All it says in Revelation 17 is that the woman is sitting on the beast, not telling us who is in charge of what. The woman is sitting on the beast. And in history we'll find, and this was one episode, there was always this hate-love relationship between the beast, i.e. the state, the empire, and the church. Always this controversy as who is supposed to be in charge. And these guys were fighting each other many, many times. I am saying this because in the book of Revelation you will also find in the 17th chapter that the time will come when those 10 nations or groups of nations which will be forming will hate the woman, will persecute the woman, that fallen woman. In other words, another fight is going to happen. The assumption from the scripture is that they will start taking over the riches of the woman. That has happened in history many times. Hitler, many don't know this, had in mind to wipe out Orthodox Christianity, meaning the Catholic Church and the Protestant Church, after the war. Mussolini, even though he was Catholic in name only, became more or less an atheist. Then later he kind of turned back to the quote-unquote Catholic faith somewhat. He had in mind to wipe out the Roman Catholic Church. So when we look at the situation today, and the fact that many of the European nations are not that quote-unquote Catholic as we would think they should be, and then starting to think, oh, there's something wrong with our teachings, and therefore we have to come up with alternative scenarios, don't understand what the Bible is actually saying. It is only talking about a combination between this beast and the church. They are kind of working hand in hand. But that's the extent of it. No more than that. Going back to Charles V, he was the one who was alive when Luther started the Reformation. It says in this article, the Habsburgs opposed the Reformation and made every attempt to destroy it. In the territory of Austria, they were almost successful in preventing the new movement from gaining a foothold. And that's why you have Austria today thoroughly Catholic. Virtually no Protestants are living there. Bavaria, thoroughly Catholic. You find the Protestants in the northern parts of Germany, mainly. In Prussia, for instance, former Prussia. And so it was mainly because of the Habsburgs at the time, which suppressed the Reformation. It says, internally, as the Habsburgs consolidated their rule and re-established the supremacy of the Roman Catholic Church, the country experienced one of its greatest periods of artistic and architectural achievements. That is why this guy is so important. Charles V, the last one who was crowned by the Pope as Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, in this particular case of the German, or you would say Austrian nation, was thoroughly Catholic, thoroughly opposed to the Reformation, saw to it that the supremacy of the Catholic Church would be maintained. The next one we need to quickly refer to is the 8th resurrection under Napoleon I, Napoleon Bonaparte. Now, we probably know more about him than we probably did about Charles V or maybe even Otto the Great, but maybe we don't know everything yet, because taking again from the book Living Words of History, notice what it says about Napoleon. It says it was only by chance that France's greatest military genius was a Frenchman at all. Corsica, where he was born in 1769, had only been acquired by France from Genoa the year before. Actually, Napoleon was the second son of a poor Corsican lawyer of noble and probably Italian descent. So in all likelihood, Napoleon wasn't French at all. He was Italian. In this article, it goes on to say that he became, quote-unquote, a superman. He had supreme military talents. He was endowed with astonishing industry and physical stamina. He could work or write for hours on end. Food and sleep seemed unnecessary to him. His ambitions, like his vanity and selfishness, were boundless. No moral scruples restrained him. No man must stand in his way. In 1804, Napoleon attains the glory of being crowned by the Pope Emperor of the French. Now, what actually happened, you all heard the story. The Pope had the crown, and Napoleon took the crown from the hands of the Pope and placed it on his own head. Nevertheless, accepting the title of Emperor of the Roman Empire, because that's what he was reestablishing. In this article, Kingdoms of Europe, it says, on December 2, 1804, he was crowned in Notre Dame in great splendor. The Pope was present, but Bonaparte placed the crown on his own head, and he gave his soldiers eagle standards in memory of the old Roman Empire. The next year, 1811, Napoleon's desire was fulfilled. His new wife presented him with a little son to perpetuate his imperial line, and the baby was promptly crowned King of Rome. It is also interesting how he won over the French. He made the Roman Catholic Church the only nationally accepted church in France. I have an article here by a German magazine, again PM, pointing this out. He actually made a concordat with the Roman Catholic Church and made the Roman Catholic Church the national church of France, which, by the way, it is still today. And also this article points out that even the Arch-Chancellor of the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation, Karl Theodor von Dalberg. Today we have one Karl Theodor von something else, Gutenberg. You probably heard that name. This guy has the same first names, Karl Theodor von, and then it was Dalberg. He said he wished that Napoleon would take over even the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation, because that's the kind of a guy they wanted. Now, his was kind of short-lived, but he nevertheless, definitely, we can see, constituted the Eighth Resurrection. Now, let's quickly talk about the Ninth, and then that will be all the time I have for today. The Ninth Resurrection, we have said, was brought about by Mussolini and Hitler. Again, how do we know that? How can we say that? How can you be convinced that that is true? Now, again, I have this book, Living World of History. It talks a little bit about Mussolini. Benito Mussolini, the son of a blacksmith, was a man of violent and boastful character, fiery patriotism, and flaming ambition. Supported by the legends of the black-shirted fascist gangs, named after the Latin name fasces or rods, which in ancient Roman times had been carried before the chief magistrate, he seized power in 1922 and became himself a dictator. He entertained fantastic ideas about reviving the glory of the ancient Roman Empire. In 1935-36, cynically disregarding the solemn covenant of the League of Nations, he invaded the next Abyssinia, or Ethiopia, as it is later called. And of course, the only country which came to his support at that time was Germany, and so he came about this connection between Germany and Italy. He also talked about the fact, or this article talks about the fact, that he invaded Egypt from the neighboring Italian colony of Libya. And if you look at Daniel 11 and Daniel 12, you find that Mussolini apparently fulfilled a prophecy there in part, where he invaded Egypt, where he invaded Libya, but that another fulfillment is still coming, where the king of the north is going to invade all those countries again, and in addition to it, the Holy Land, something which, of course, Mussolini liked to do, but didn't do, didn't accomplish. I'd like to read to you what he did insofar as the Catholic Church is concerned. Again, this is taken from an article from, in this particular case, John Kirschhorn. Now, John Kirschhorn, it says here, has had 25 years of experience at the Associated Press, the New York Times, and the CBC News, CBS News. He says in this article, Mussolini promised them he would end disorder and corruption and recreate the glory of the Roman Empire. Among his admirers was Adolf Hitler, who introduced the Roman salute to his Nazis and dressed his bodyguard in black shirts. And then it has the subsection, reviving the Roman Empire. And then it says, the stream of a new Roman Empire led to the conquest of Ethiopia in 1935 in defiance of the League of Nations. He goes on to say, grandeur for Mussolini meant building, empire building. In 1934, Mussolini said, after the Rome of the Caesars, after that of the Popes, today there is a new Rome, fascist Rome. His dream was to be called Mare Nostrum, or our Mediterranean, extending from Palestine to Egypt and throughout parts of Africa. Mussolini's recreation of the Roman Empire was commemorated by the monumental construction of the Via dell'Imperio. Mussolini attempted to turn monuments of Augustan Rome into symbols of the fascist doctrine. His goals in doing so were to validate his role as the founder of the new Roman Empire. So this man knows nothing about the Bible, I don't think, but he just relates historical facts. He recognized in himself a parallel to the Roman emperors, Augustus in particular. During the speech he delivered upon the installation of the first fascist governor of Rome on December 31, 1925, he made his plans for a new Rome public. Within 5 years, he says, Rome must strike all the nations of the world as a source of wonder, huge, well-organized, powerful, as it was at the time of the Augustan Empire. And then it goes on to say that he stood up as a symbol to seamlessly showing the continuity of the Roman Empire. But not only that, let us also not forget that he made a treaty with the Pope, the so-called Lateran Pact of 1929, and I'm reading here again from the book Kingdoms of Europe, consisted of a treaty between Italy and the Holy See, and a concordat regulating relations between the Italian state and the Catholic Church. The treaty created the independent state of Vatican City, recognized the sovereignty of the Pope. In the concordat, the Church was assured of jurisdiction in ecclesiastical matters. Canon law was reorganized as superseding the civil code in such areas as marriage. The Church was restored to its role in education and allowed incumbent operation of its press and communication facilities. And not only that, he also established the Roman Catholic Church as the national religion of Italy, which it is still today, like Napoleon did for the French. In an article, in a German article, and I have to make sure that I don't go over time here, otherwise we can't get it on the CD. In a German article, also pointed out that he thought he was God, a God, and that people were supposed to worship him, which they did. In going to the internet, I found another article, which is the last one I'm going to read today, from the Wikipedia, about his religious beliefs. And again, it shows the hate-love relationship between the Church and the Roman Catholic Church and the state. This article says Mussolini was raised by a devoutly Catholic mother and an anti-clerical father. His mother, Rosa, had him baptized into the Roman Catholic Church and took her children to services every Sunday. His father never attended. Mussolini would become anti-clerical like his father. As a young man, he proclaimed himself to be an atheist and several times tried to shock an audience by calling on God to strike him dead. He denounced socialists who were tolerant of religion or who had their children baptized. He believed that science had proven there was no God and that the historical Jesus was ignorant and mad. Mussolini made attacks against Christianity and the Catholic Church. But despite those attacks, Mussolini would try to win popular support by appeasing the Catholic majority in Italy. In 1924, Mussolini saw that three of his children were given communion. In 1925, he had a priest perform a religious marriage ceremony for himself and his wife, whom he had married in a civil ceremony 10 years earlier. On February 11, 1929, he signed a concordat and treaty with the Roman Catholic Church. Under the Lateran Pact, Vatican City was granted independent statehood and so on, and the Catholic religion was recognized as Italy's state religion. The Church also regained authority over marriage. Catholicism could be taught in all secondary schools. Birth control and Freemasonry were banned, and the clergy received subsidies from the state and was exempted from taxation. Pope Pius XI praised Mussolini, and the official Catholic newspaper pronounced Italy was given back to God and God to Italy. Mussolini publicly reconciled with the Pope, Pope Pius XI, in 1932, but took care to exclude from the newspapers and photography, or any photography, of himself kneeling or showing deference to the Pope. He wanted to persuade Catholics that fascism was Catholic, and he himself a believer who spent some of each day in prayer. The Pope began referring to Mussolini as a man sent by Providence. Despite Mussolini's efforts to appear pious by order of his party, pronouns referring to him had to be capitalized, like those referring to God. After his fall from power in 1943, Mussolini began speaking more about God and the obligations of conscience, although he had little sense and use for the priests and the sacraments of the Church, despite his return to the Catholic faith. He also began drawing parallels between himself and Jesus Christ, and he was convinced of Pope Pius XI's earlier statements that he had been sent by God to redeem society. So we see the kind of odd relationship between the Church and the state, something which we are going to experience again when we talk about the last resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, as we are seeing it right now developing in Europe. We should not be all confused about the fact that the Roman Catholic Church may not have such much of an influence right now as you might think it should have. The teachings of the Roman Catholic Church have been around all along. And the fact that Sunday is the day which is going to be worshipped, that's not going to change. The fact that we find that the European Constitution, the Lisbon Treaty, is based on religious, quote-unquote, Orthodox Christian teachings, that's not going to change. The fact that most of the European nations who are going to be part of the 10 nations, or core of nations in my estimation, are going to be Catholic, that's not going to change. But you shouldn't expect that there is going to be such a hand-in-glove relationship, because the book of Daniel tells us that even those 10 nations, they're kind of iron, I mean, they're kind of, really not fitting together that well, they're kind of together and kind of not. And as we said, there will ultimately come the time when even those 10 nations or groups of nations will hate what the Catholic Church stands for and will start even retaliating against that church. Now, I hope I have given you a nice overview as to what from history books and historical records we can see what happened and why we are teaching what we are teaching. And you can take the time and go into more detail if you want to, but I hope you make this part of your own convictions, because that's what it's all about. So that when people come and tell you differently, you know they're wrong. And you know why they're wrong.